Any questions? Go ahead.
If not, we'd like to move into eligibility. And if we look on page 57, these are the programs in which we determine eligibility for Oregonians as they come into our office. And our projection is that we do eligibility determinations on 91,000 individuals over the course of the biennium. And the different programs that we determine eligibility for, as you can see, are 8 separate and distinct programs. Without running them down, all of them have different resource limits, they have different income limits, and they provide different benefits to people as they come in and out of our offices. In fact, we spend quite a bit of time and quite a bit of effort on determining eligibility for the different programs. Needless to say, you have to be poor, you have to be frail to be able to get services under any of these programs. And most of them are, in fact, either federal programs or federal guidelines we have to follow. So there are changes that happen from time to time that we need to put into our system, and we need to train people on determining eligibility. And it is, in fact, a very labor-intensive process where people come into our offices, or we go to their homes and do one-on-one interviews and talk with them about the types of documentation we need to have from them in order to determine eligibility. And generally, again, it revolves around income and revolves around what type of assets they have. We also spend time with them and talk about services that we don't specifically provide, but they might be in need of, and specifically food, shelter, and transportation. We work with them on choosing a health plan under the Oregon Health Plan if they are in fact found eligible. Generally, we start with those questions and make those assessments about where they are currently, who their primary care provider is. We assess their physical and psychosocial needs in helping them choose a health plan that's going to be right for them. We do spend time looking at resources to try to help avoid the client's spouse from entering poverty, where we do have a spouse in the picture. And in fact, we look at and make an assessment of impairment if in fact someone needs long-term care services. So this is all done, again, with sometimes it's not all 91,000 because not all of them need all the services of all the programs, but when we interview them, we obviously are looking for what their needs are, what their income is, and what their resources are. If you take a look at the chart on page 59, you can see that we in fact do have a lot of eligible clients in different programs. There is some double count here. There are some people who are Medicaid eligible who also are eligible for the food stamp program. It just, again, it gives you an indication of the volume of people that we see and work with to determine eligibility for the different programs. Any questions on, and it was a quick run through on eligibility, but questions?
Just real quick, you know, you often don't think, at least I don't, when I think of food stamps, I don't think of the elderly.
Yes.
And yet you're saying that there's 45,000 people that are eligible for food stamps among the elderly population.
Elderly and disabled, yes.
Number one, how does it break down between elderly and disabled? Number two, of the 45,000 of those that are eligible, how many actually take advantage of the food stamp program?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can get you, and we'll get you the numbers of the breakdown between elderly and disabled populations on the food stamp program. Generally, when we list numbers of food stamp eligible, that means actual people
that are actually using
them. Correct.
Okay.
And we'll be glad to get to that number certainly by tomorrow, if not by the end of the session today. We'd like to at this point, move into our cash assistance programs, and I think, Dan, we're going to turn back to you. Is that right on page 61?
That's right. members of the committee, on page 61, we list the amount of money we spend in cash grants and the number of cases. And I guess the first thing you'll see is that the number of cases in the general assistance program on the right side of page 61 is very small, 2931 in the governor's budget, but the largest share of this $3 million expenditure goes to those clients. And I'll come back to the general assistance program because of that in just a moment. The other two pieces of this program are the Oregon Supplemental Income Program, in which we spend about $2.4 million, and the Special Needs Program, in which we spend about $5.9 million. Oregon Supplemental Income is a program, frankly, that we continued because of a federal maintenance of effort requirement. We are required to maintain the amount of additional money paid to SSI recipients that we did, that we made at some point in the 1970s. I'm not sure what the exact date was. And in fact, we provide a grant of $1.70 a month under this program. So, as you can see, we wouldn't do it if not for the maintenance of effort requirement. We have, in recent years, made that into an annualized payment to reduce the administrative costs of doing this, but that's why we have the OSIP program. Special Needs Program is different and has a more important programmatic value. It is a program in which we provide in some cases, shelter exceptions, in some cases, telephone allowances to clients who are living in their own homes and who are so poor that they need those things to make their care setting work. In many cases, we will have an in-home client who has an appropriate accessible apartment, but the rent on that apartment will be more than the standard that's allowed under SSI. And the reason we make the shelter exception payment is because it is better for them and more cost-effective for us to maintain the client in her own home than it is to have her go to a different care setting. So we spend, in the context of the budget, a relatively small amount of money on special needs payments. If you turn to page 62, there's a brief description of the general assistance program, which is the big piece of our cash assistance program. And in this program, we provide cash grants to individuals who are in the process of applying for federal supplemental security income or federal Social Security disability income, the two major federal disability programs. In order to be deemed eligible for this, an individual has to have a severe physical or mental disability that is believed to make them unemployable for a period of 12 months or more. And they have to be people who we anticipate will be eligible for the federal disability program. And they also have to be extremely poor. They have to have assets of less than $1,500, and they have to have no more than $50 in cash, and they have to have income under the GA grant, which this year is $298 a month. The thing about this program is people are in the process of applying for SSI, and that's a fact that I'm going to come back to in just a little bit. But before I do that, I'm going to give you an example of a general assistance client. The person we've identified here, Julia, is 57-year-old woman who worked as a fry cook before she had a stroke. At first, she needed help in caring for herself, but after several months, she was able to to essentially do her daily care on her own. She has been evaluated as being unable to return to gainful employment. Part of that, frankly, comes from her age. Part of it comes from the fact that she has limited education. And part of it comes from the fact that, although she has had a long work history up to this point, it has been almost entirely in heavy manual labor of one sort or another. So when the folks use the sort of the standard method for evaluating her employability, she's someone who doesn't look like she's going to have much success at being employable, given her new physical disability. She has partial paralysis. Her speech and short-term memory are permanently impaired. And she has made application for the Federal Disability Program, SSI. So what we are doing under this program is we're giving her a grant of $298 a month, which is meant primarily to help with housing costs. An individual like this would also be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan and for food stamps. That gives you a good sense of who would be involved.
Dan, where would this woman live on $298 a month?
She would either have to share space with someone else, which is not uncommon, or in some communities, SRO housing is still available. Single-room occupancy housing is still available for that, obviously. One doesn't get much of an apartment for $298 a month.
But for example, she might rent a room in somebody's house.
That's possible. If you take a look at page 60,
Vital General Assistance. I've heard of a program that I don't understand. Maybe you can tell me. It's called the GATAP program. What's that? What's its status?
The GATAP program, which TAP stands for Temporary Assistance Program, was a program that was funded for this biennium. And the purpose of the program was to provide a grant for legal non-citizens who were indigent. There were some changes in the federal law regarding non-citizens in 1996, I think it was. And basically, people who previously could have gotten federal SSI became no longer able to get SSI. Now, those who are currently on the program at the date of enactment, which I think was August 26, 1996, were grandfathered in, but individuals who would have been able to newly become SSI eligible after that date were no longer able to get federal supplemental security income. And so last session, the legislature funded a very small program, I think initially set at $1.5 million of general fund, to provide grants for these individuals. That program was meant to sunset on June 30th of this year, and under the governor's budget, it does sunset.
Are the people in that program all taken care of because of federal changes, or what's going to happen to the people?
No, there is a small number, and I can get you the number of folks who are on that. And I say small, that's a relative thing. It's over 100 folks who are on that program, who some of whom are in the process of applying for citizenship, but certainly all of whom will not have achieved citizenship by the end of this fiscal year. And I would expect actually a relatively small number of them will have achieved citizenship.
Madam Chair, by way of explanation, in Southeast Portland, my church has an Indo-Chinese socialization center with a lot of folks that are not citizens, but they've been here since the Vietnam War era. You know, they've been here 20 years or whatever. And because they didn't become citizens, even if they have post-traumatic stress disorder or whatever, a real disability, the citizenship status thing means, after all these years, they're cut off. And some of the counselors have actually told me a story where some of them have considered committing suicide because they have a proud tradition where they don't want to be a burden to anybody, you know, to their families. And it's just kind of a program that's very small, but it kind of gets overlooked from time to time in the bigness of all of our other programs.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, if I might, I was at that center and had opportunity to have breakfast with a group of people and saw the real impact. And there have been a lot of changes at the federal level. We are not hearing at this point of great need to try to fill that gap. So I would be very interested if you were hearing something different, because we are not hearing it. The federal government has gone back and has made changes in that in those laws, which in fact were, I think, very harmful to legal non-citizens who had been here for a long time. So again, any knowledge of people who are in need, we'd certainly like to know about it. Just not hearing about it yet.
I appreciate Rogers having been there. And I was kind of asking for an update because I can't keep up with it all either. And I'm hoping that the federal government has made adequate adjustments to that program.
Just to follow up here, Dan, what will happen to these 100 folks who are going to be cut off on June 30th?
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, these people will lose the $298 a month they are receiving. And, you know, staff in our offices will work with them to attempt to find other arrangements, but we will not have a program, a financial program, to be able to continue that grant.
So will they then become homeless? Is that, it will add to our homeless population, what they're going to do?
It is possible that some of them might become homeless.
I guess that's good. Our communities and our churches and people in neighborhoods need to get ready, be knowledgeable about that fact, and offer a helping hand.
If I can call your attention to page 65 and get to another reduction option in the budget. And this is rather a complicated one to explain, but basically what happened in the preparation of the budget was that we projected, again, the caseload for the general assistance program, as we do with our program. And as Rose Martin mentioned before, this program, like OPI, is one of those programs that has traditionally, in the budget-making process, been flat. And that's why you can see on page 64 that the caseload for 9901 is expected to be basically flat. The governor proposed what I guess in essence is a change in methodology for calculating this budget. And instead of basing the projection on caseload, what has been substituted is a projection that takes the budget from this biennium and grows it by 2% for next biennium. And that results in a reduction below current service level of $989,000. I guess what I would say about this that I think is important that everyone knows, but is not included in this document because this document presents the governor's recommended budget, is that subsequent to our projection of the current service level, the caseload in this program has dropped rather substantially. And we are now anticipating a caseload of roughly 100 clients fewer next biennium than we were anticipating at the time of the governor's budget preparation. And as a result of that, with this amount of money, we believe we will be able to maintain the grants for those folks who remain eligible for the program and give a reasonable inflation factor. So we would move the grant to $303 a month next biennium for the first year, and then go up another $6 a month in the second year of the biennium. And the only reason we're able to do that is because estimated caseload has dropped.
And to what do you attribute the drop in caseload?
A very good and unfortunately complicated question. One piece of that has to do with a rule change that went into effect in 1998. Feedback is going clear. I'm happy to try. One change is a change that we made in rules in, I'm not sure, in 1998, and that required monitoring of drug and alcohol treatment plans, and people had to leave the GA program if they were out of compliance with their treatment plan.
Yeah, it would work here. Works for me.
Okay, so I'll try it. I think this is pretty good. This is much better. So that caused some individuals to not be able to continue on the program. And that was part of the caseload drop. One of the things I think that also acts in this program, even though individuals are disabled and are certified, if you will, to be disabled for a 12-month period, sort of at the margin, at the lowest end of the disability there, some of those folks can, in fact, work. And in a good economy, there are more opportunities for work. And I think that we have had an extended period of a strong labor market. And so we may have some decline in caseload due to that. We haven't been able to quantify. On page 66, I'd like to call your attention to a page that describes a policy package that appears in the governor's budget. This page is titled Supplemental Security Income Recovery, and one of the things I need to tell you about the General Assistance Program is that we provide grants now of $298 a month to disabled individuals who are in the process of applying for federal disability programs. If they are deemed eligible for federal supplemental security income program, which is one of the two major programs, when they are deemed eligible, the state is paid back the amount of general assistance that it has advanced them to that point. We have a small number of staff people, I think it's 12, who work with general assistance clients who are in the process of applying for a federal disability program. It's a complicated process, and it's one that having a guide who understands the process and can help you fill out the forms and who can advocate for you at some of the hearing levels is very important then. And what the governor is proposing here is that we add staff to the SFI liaison program, who are folks who will be able to work with the general assistance clients in making their applications. And we've estimated that if we return ourselves to the ratio of SSI liaisons to general assistance clients that we had back in 1993, we should be able to bring up our collection rate under this program. And we're anticipating for a general fund investment of $1 million in staffing costs. We should be able to generate other fund collections that will allow us to reduce the need for general fund by $2.8 million. The net is $1.8 million.
Any questions of the committee?
Madam Chair, in our last remaining minutes, if we can get through just one more section, we'll be that much further ahead.
Sure.
We want to keep on moving. Okay,
yeah,
then I'm going to ask Cindy Hannum to come up, who I introduced and was here on Monday. She's the Assistant Administrator for Senior Disabled Services for Long-Term Care Quality. And Cindy is going to go through the licensing section with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Cindy Hannum. I'm on pages, starting with page 67, where you actually see a graph of all of the number of beds and the number of care settings. Again, when we talk about the licensing quality piece, we're actually talking about facilities where most of the people residing there are not Medicaid eligible folks. So this is a very important service for all elderly and disabled individuals. Going on quickly, page 69, the quality efforts that we engage in really are a very balanced approach, and I want to emphasize to you that while the regulatory pieces, which is the licensing, inspection, checking into complaints and so forth, are a very important we also have a variety of other issues that we engage in trying to improve quality. Under those regulatory pieces, SDSC writes the rules for all of these care settings. We do this through a very collaborative process. We have the industry at the table, advocates and so forth, because we think the best rulemaking, in fact, takes into account the views of all folks. For the actual inspection process, SCSD has three client care monitoring offices. One is in Medford, one in Albany, one in Tualatin. And there we have surveyors who are doing the inspections for all of the licensed nursing facilities in the state, the residential care facilities, and ALF, assisted living facilities. We also respond to any sorts of system-wide complaints about those facilities. But a very important part of the actual complaint investigation has to do with local area agency on aging offices and our own senior and disabled service officers, because here we have state law, we have wonderful laws in our state where any complaint of neglect, abuse has to be investigated. We have very prompt time frames for that. And in fact, we have done in 1998 over 3,500 investigations. In terms of how many are actually substantiated, in other words, the findings of fact found that it did occur, that varies from about 25% to 30%. So many things are of concern to complainants, to citizens, to families, but there does not necessarily mean that the facility was at fault. We also have the corrective action piece, which means that we have sanction authority over all of these facilities. Sanctions are a very valuable tool to the division to help improve practice. They are not meant to be solely punishment. They are a way to call to a facility's attention for practice and to affect change. And in very severe settings, we actually revoke licenses. We have, in 1998, we fined about $150,000 between all of these facilities. And in addition, the federal government for nursing facility care has the authority to exercise their own fines, which ranges around $20,000. We also have other tools that are done for the sanction process, such as restricting the number of people who can enter a facility. Something I think we're very proud of in our sanction process is we afford all providers an informal appeal to the division, which means we take the time to meet with them, to talk about the problems they're having, and they do not have to necessarily go through a full-blown contested case hearing process. Over on the next page, see, I'm just moving right on here. quality, however, the way that we best achieve quality is not simply to sanction and to inspect and to regulate. So we are engaging in a variety of practices. Some of them we do ourselves, some with local offices such as area agencies on aging. We're doing a lot with the industry itself. And these include training activities. Great amounts of training are occurring both in terms of skills for caregivers, in terms of standards of regulations and so forth. We offer on-site consultation to providers in these care settings so that we can offer technical assistance on-site. We have staff who are working on facility means of gaining quality internally and teaching them methods for them to look at systems within their facilities so that they can be the keepers of quality. And we're also trying to improve our consumer education and advocacy efforts to help make consumers not only make good informed choice about care and where they want to live, but how to advocate for themselves within facilities so that they can resolve problems without necessarily having to file complaints with the division. So we have in the past 2 years under Roger's leadership really engaged in strong efforts to improve quality. And this is not only through the regulatory process, as I mentioned, but through our training and teaching activities, which we do with provider associations and so forth. You can see for the budget, there are 142 positions listed. This is a variety of things. This includes those surveyors in the client care monitoring offices that I described to you. It includes corrective action staff and program staff who work in central office. And this includes foster home licensors. And I might mention for the foster home program, the actual licensors throughout the state are in local area agency and SDSD offices. Surveyors do not do that out of client care monitoring offices. And we have two counties who have elected to do county ordinance for foster homes, Clackamas and Multnomah. And so they're under local government jurisdiction. And I would be pleased to answer any questions from the committee.
Can you talk about the special quality improvement project on team management here?
Oh, thank you.
Because you care about that.
Let me ask if I could have you touch on that tomorrow. Would that be all right? What we're going to do tomorrow is we will have public testimony, but we will allow your division to complete their presentation. Do you have an idea how, I mean, how that, it didn't look like too much.
Well, Madam Chair, we have been working very hard with you to be both as clear as we can and responsive as we can while moving through a lot of material. And I want to say that only to give myself a little time to take a look and give you a reasonable estimate. I believe that we're probably a good 45 minutes to an hour away.
Okay.
That is my belief. Dan? And I think that if things are going well, I think that will take us 45 minutes.
We can do some on Monday. So we could take a little bit of time on Monday.
We'll certainly.
I want to give enough time for public testimony.
We will be here ready to go both tomorrow and Monday.
Right. You will try to be here, too.
No, I'm sorry that we're late today.
So I apologize for our not being able to. But with that, we will adjourn for today and reconvene tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
Thank you.
Thank you.